Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's session is entitled Understanding Pediatric NMO, ADEM, and TM. My name is Roberta Pesce, and I'm the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association, and we are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. We're pleased that Sam Huge from UT Southwestern Dallas, Texas is joining us as our guest moderator for today. And before I turn it over to Sam, a few housekeeping pieces. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis. Sam, could you start us off by introducing our speakers?
Sure. Thanks, Roberta. I'm happy to be guest hosting this podcast today, and I'm pleased to be joined by Drs. Benjamin Greenberg and Terry Schreiner. Dr. Greenberg is recognized internationally as an expert in rare autoimmune disorders of the central nervous system. He splits his time clinically between seeing both adult and pediatric patients. His research interests are in both the diagnosis and treatment of transverse myelitis, neuromyelitis optica, encephalitis, multiple sclerosis, and infections of the central nervous system. He has also led an effort to improve biorepository development and has created uniform protocols for sample handling and analysis. Dr. Schreiner is a neuroimmunology specialist at the University of Colorado and pediatric neurologist at Children's Hospital Colorado. She is subspecialized in pediatric onset demyelinating disorders of the central nervous system and has begun a multidisciplinary clinic for children with these disorders. Her areas of interest include immune-mediated neurologic disease, quality of life in pediatric patients with demyelinating diseases, biomarkers of multiple sclerosis, and participation in clinical trials. Thank you to our expert panelists for joining us today. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us and sending us your questions in advance. I will do my best to get through as many of the questions as we can today in the next hour. So to start us off, Dr. Greenberg, could you please provide us an overview of ADEM, NMO, and TM in kids as we understand these diseases today?
Sure, Sam. And thank you for moderating today and obviously to the TMA for sponsoring the podcast. I find them extremely valuable. The question about diagnosis of TM, ADEM, and NMO in children as well as adults is an interesting one because it's been evolving over time. There is the historical definitions that are based on the phenotype, meaning what symptoms do the patients present with and what are their MRI findings. And the most basic or simplistic definitions separate out patients this way. Transverse myelitis is a disorder where the spinal cord is inflamed. Acute disseminated encephalomyelitis is a disorder where the brain is inflamed and may involve the spinal cord as well. So one way to think about it is ADEM patients may have spinal cord involvement, hence transverse myelitis, but not all transverse myelitis patients have ADEM because their brain is spared. It gets more confusing when we talk about neuromyelitis optica because in general, historically, this disease was defined as individuals who had inflammation of the spinal cord and optic nerves. They may not happen simultaneously. One event may happen followed by another, so somebody could have transverse myelitis and then optic neuritis, but if they had had those events and a normal brain, then they would be diagnosed with neuromyelitis optica. So our definitions were purely based on what part of the central nervous system was affected and in what pattern. That's changed over time as we started developing tests for these disorders, specifically neuromyelitis optica. With the advent of a blood test, the anti-aquaporin 4 antibody, sometimes called the NMO-IgG, we have found a group of patients who are different than the traditional definition, but indeed have the disorder, neuromyelitis optica. And so the diagnostic criteria have changed, and it is now possible when somebody presents with just optic neuritis or just transverse myelitis, if they have a positive blood test for this antibody, to diagnose them with neuromyelitis optica. There are no specific blood tests or spinal fluid tests yet for ADEM or transverse myelitis. That is something we are working on. And the last point I would make is around the confusion around terminology for transverse myelitis. Most of the time, when we, meaning us here at UT, I'm sure Dr. Schreiner's group in Colorado or other centers around the country who focus on these diseases, use the term transverse myelitis, we're really referring to people who have had this as an idiopathic event, meaning it's not part of neuromyelitis optica, it's not part of multiple sclerosis, it's not part of ADEM. And so these are individuals who have isolated inflammation of the spinal cord and no evidence of other systemic diseases.
Thank you, Dr. Greenberg. Kind of following up with that question, moving into some questions about the diagnosis and prognosis of these diseases, do you see any difference between these diagnoses of TM and NMO and ADEM between children and adults? Are they the same diseases or are they different?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'll give the first answer and actually have Dr. Schreiner chime in as well. So in the broadest sense of the terms of these conditions, there is a significant amount of overlap between adults and children. But when we really take each group, there are patterns within pediatric transverse myelitis that are distinct from what I see in adults, and the same is true for ADEM. ADEM is much more common in kids than adults, and in adults, when we see patients present with a condition that meets the criteria for ADEM, there is a higher rate of conversion to multiple sclerosis than we may see in children. With transverse myelitis, what we found is that in kids with transverse myelitis, we see the damage to the spinal cord affecting different parts of the spinal cord in a pattern that seems to be unique from adults. So specifically, when we look at the anatomy of the spinal cord, your connection from your brain to your muscles requires two wires, a wire that goes from your brain to the spinal cord and then a wire that goes from your spinal cord to the muscle, these two different nerves. In adult transverse myelitis patient, pretty much uniformly the damage is to the first wire, the upper motor neuron. In kids, we see a much higher number of children who get mixed patterns of damage where both wire number one and wire number two gets damaged. And that can lead to difficulties in diagnosis and differences in treatment and prognosis. And I'm not sure, I'll actually put Dr. Schreiner on the spot. I'm not sure if this is a pattern that she sees in her clinic as well, but it's something that we've become more aware of over these last couple years, these kids who have both wires injured as a result of transverse myelitis.
Thank you, Dr. Greenberg. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I'm very honored to have been included in the TMA podcast. In answer to your question, yes, I do see that, and I do see that more in my pediatric patients than in my adult patients, namely a pattern of paralysis that appears more flaccid. The limb that's affected is weak, certainly, but in a different way than what we would observe in an adult TM patient, particularly acutely, but even as the disease evolves and the patient begins to recover. In the acute presentation, what this means is that transverse myelitis can sometimes clinically be confused with a different kind of inflammatory disorder in kids called, well, can occur in adults as well, but Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an inflammation of the second wire. So differentiating those two diseases becomes very important, and the tool that we use to do that mostly is the MRI, as the findings would be somewhat different for those diagnostically in the short term. Other tools include things like the lumbar puncture, which would show differences between the two diseases. So as I think more broadly about diagnosis and prognosis of these three different diseases, I'll start with transverse myelitis. Between children and adults, I see in children often, and I think the literature has supported, that difficulty with bladder and bowel function is very commonly seen. It's almost universal. I think the one study that I've read recently showed 80% of kids will present with a difficulty voiding or moving their bowels. And unfortunately, this is something that often persists after the acute phase. So for up to a year, there can be difficulties with this, and unfortunately, even beyond in a smaller percentage of patients. So that's one thing I think about when I think about transverse myelitis in children. We know that about 20% of all patients with transverse myelitis will present in childhood, and among those children, there seem to be a peak in very young children, so infants and toddlers, and then later in adolescents. And this can make diagnosis difficult because in an infant, obviously, you're going to be limited, that those children are not toilet trained, they're in diapers. That's one clue that may not be immediately apparent in their presentation. For prognosis in children, we've observed that in the very young pediatric TM patients, the prognosis does tend to be worse. The other factors that participate in how someone will do after a transverse myelitis include where in the spinal cord the inflammation has occurred, certain factors of what the MRI looks like, and there's more attention being paid now to whether or not there are clues in the cerebrospinal fluid that portend a worse prognosis as well. For acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, this is predominantly a disease of childhood. And so when I think about diagnosing ADEM in an adult, it makes me a little nervous. I think that it becomes imperative before diagnosing ADEM in an adult to really look for other causes. And as you mentioned, Dr. Greenberg, that it's more common in adults diagnosed with ADEM to subsequently go on and have other attacks than it is in children diagnosed with ADEM. There are reports of ADEM occurring twice, but by and large, this is a disease that is monophasic, meaning it just happens once and occurs in a population that usually has had some recent viral infection or an immunization. For neuromyelitis optica, as you mentioned, the diagnosis is very similar between the adult and the pediatric population. I think historically we've thought that in children presenting with neuromyelitis optica, it's more common to have both eyes affected at the time of presentation, and subsequent studies have not really supported this. So what we think now is that a pediatric patient presenting with NMO for the first time may have just an isolated optic neuritis or may have just an inflammation of the spinal cord, and then the diagnosis requires other features to support that. NMO is a disease that can happen just once and/or could be relapsing and occur throughout one's lifetime. And differentiating that at the beginning, well, we have some clues, but that sometimes is difficult. And the prognosis really depends on how many events in a patient's lifetime they have and where in the central nervous system those attacks occur.
Thank you, Dr. Schreiner. That was very informative. And to follow up with some questions regarding the specific recoveries, what do we understand about how children recover from TM and ADEM and even NMO, and what can be done to maximize the potential for recovery?
Well, I think one of the things I like most about working with children is that they do recover. They have such a capacity for recovery after an attack to the central nervous system. The things that I emphasize most in my patients pertaining to recovery for these three diseases start first with, as soon as the diagnosis is made, whatever that may be, making sure that the treatment is appropriate and aggressive. So we want to minimize the damage that is done as soon as we can. So that, I think of, is really the first important intervention, a proper diagnosis, a correct diagnosis, and then an intervention. And I know we'll speak a little bit more about that later in the podcast. After the acute intervention has been made, I think recovery can be supported by therapy, rehabilitation, or in some cases we call it habilitation. So providing as much intervention to maximize motor function as possible. And this is inpatient rehabilitation, home rehabilitation, use of techniques such as functional electrical stimulation, the FES, which can come, is often used in a bike, to stimulate the muscles that are downstream of where the damage in the central nervous system or the peripheral nervous system has occurred. I think the things that are sometimes overlooked in terms of recovery are the basics. So we want to make sure that these children are sleeping well, are eating well, getting as much exercise as they can, having all of the what I would call downstream effects of this event attended to. So making sure that they are not developing pressure ulcers if they are in a bed or in a chair for a prolonged period of time. Making sure that if they are having difficulty with urinary or bowel function, that those things are attended to as well, not only to facilitate recovery, but certainly to prevent any further damage from occurring. I think I'll pause right there.
So, Dr. Greenberg, there's one specific question. What are the chances that my child will have multiple sclerosis, with TM being the first manifestation? Our physician reminds us that this is always still a possibility.
Yeah, it's a question I fear that that we hear a lot about from families and from patients. And so in general, there are two things at the time of transverse myelitis that will dictate the relative risk of it being a first event of multiple sclerosis. And the two pieces of data that are most important are MRI findings of the brain and spinal fluid in that order. And so the way the numbers break down are, if you have transverse myelitis and a normal brain MRI, your risk of it being multiple sclerosis is probably in the 10 to 30% range. So the overwhelming majority of people do not have multiple sclerosis. If you have an MRI that shows two or more abnormalities on the MRI that look suspicious for demyelination, then we quote a risk of, say, 80%. Sometimes higher, depending on the pattern, of it being multiple sclerosis. So that brain MRI at the time of the event makes a big difference. The second test is the spinal fluid, which is not as big a predictor. So, for example, if we take that person who had transverse myelitis and a normal brain MRI and superimpose a normal spinal fluid, no evidence that the immune system is overactive in the spinal fluid, using a test called oligoclonal bands, which is an imprecise test, then we can take somebody in that 10 to 30% range and put them down in the 10% range if their oligoclonal band test is negative. So the ideal situation for a transverse myelitis patient is to have a normal brain MRI, a spinal fluid with no oligoclonal bands, and then I quote them a, call it 10 to the high end 20% risk of it being multiple sclerosis, versus somebody who has transverse myelitis, an abnormal brain MRI, and oligoclonal bands in the spinal fluid, it's probably about an 80 to 90% chance that it represents multiple sclerosis. And so each individual patient needs to understand their own spinal fluid findings in order to gauge their relative risk of it being multiple sclerosis.
Thank you. So switching gears a little bit to discuss some questions about treatments for these diseases in kids. Dr. Greenberg, could you maybe discuss what treatments are most effective in children diagnosed with NMO?
Well, I wish I knew in terms of which were most effective. I'll tell you the ones that are used, and I have to stress when it comes to NMO that the data we have for treating the condition is based on very limited what are called open label studies. And what that means is these were not controlled in any fashion. And as a corollary to that, it means there is a chance that the conclusions we're reaching are not accurate. And so we have to remember that. In general, however, we still recommend some version of immunosuppression for patients with neuromyelitis optica. And the four most commonly used agents are prednisone, azathioprine, which is sold under the name Imuran, mycophenolate mofetil, sold as the drug Celcept, and rituximab, sold as the drug Rituxan. And each of these drugs suppress the immune system in a different way, and they, in open-label studies, seem to suppress the activity of the disease. And so they have become the mainstay of treatment. Now, we have not done any controlled trials of any of the individual drugs, and in fact, we've also not done any head-to-head trials. And so I can't say for certain which drug is best. In the open-label trials, not head-to-head, where we just followed people on these different drugs, my sense is that rituximab is having the biggest impact. But I have to stress that that is based on very limited data, uncontrolled, and that there are patients on all of these drugs that do great. And so the way we pick which drug to go on is based on a lot of factors, including are there unique risks to any individual patients with any of the specific drugs.
So moving over to Dr. Schreiner, how or why is one acute treatment option determined the best course of treatment? For example, why would IVIG be used over Plex or steroids over IVIG, et cetera?
Okay, thank you, Sam. Well, that is a great question, and that also, in the absence of definitive data that says that one is clearly superior to the other, that decision is really made on a patient-by-patient basis. So they are different therapies. So I'm going to speak specifically to intravenous immunoglobulin, or IVIG, and plasmapheresis, which we call PLEX. They are different therapies that we hope affect the immune system in a way that is beneficial for patients who have inflammation in their central nervous system. They have different side effect profiles, and sometimes it is the side effect profile in a particular patient that determines which one is used. So, for example, with plasmapheresis, a process of removing blood from the body, usually through one peripheral IV, running it through a filter that we think sort of pulls out ill humors and then returns blood through a different IV, that process can be taxing on the cardiorespiratory system for a patient. So, for example, we can see fluctuations in heart rate and blood pressure, and we can see fluctuations in electrolytes, such as sodium and potassium in particular, during this process. And so if there's concern that those fluctuations, those changes might not be well tolerated for a patient, well, then IVIG may be preferentially chosen. IVIG is pooled antibodies from, you know, hundreds if not thousands of donors infused through a peripheral IV and usually tolerated well, but there are downsides to infusing such a heavy protein load as well into a patient, and there are side effects such as like an aseptic meningitis or a very bad headache that might be taken into consideration when choosing one over the other. steroids are commonly used in conjunction with both IVIG and plasmapheresis, as I think of them kind of as the hammer. The steroids are a very non-specific way of calming down the immune system. And so they can be used in conjunction with these two, sometimes used independently. And steroids have a host of side effects that are not benign that need to be taken into consideration as well. And it is not just things like, you know, kids and adults become irritable and hungry and bloated and may have difficulty sleeping. Those are all, you know, relatively unpleasant but transient side effects, but there are more rare side effects of high-dose steroids as well, such as difficulties with the hips, that we need to take into account before instituting those therapies. And so really, for each patient that I discuss these with, we really look at the patient's individual factors and use those as we choose one therapy over the other, or in some cases start with one therapy and find that the response is insufficient and then move on to a different therapy.
And if I could make a comment about that, because I agree with Dr. Schreiner and her assessment of things, and for those of you in the community who are listening on the call, it's worth noting that this issue about acute therapy and frankly about outcomes and prognosis and multiple sclerosis is probably one of the most understudied aspects of the condition. And it's been understudied for a lot of different reasons, obviously a large portion of the reasons being related to the rarity of the conditions. But these questions need answering, and there is a study going on that the Transverse Myelitis Association is a part of called the CAPTURE study, where we are trying to identify families who have been affected by transverse myelitis within the first 3 months after their event so that we can follow them over time, even if they're not being seen at one of our centers. We can follow them by phone over time and document what treatments they received and what the outcomes were. And I would encourage everybody on this call who are spread out around the country and even around North America and further, as they hear of families in their community or friends or somebody who's been afflicted by this condition, please, please, please encourage those individuals to rapidly get in touch with the Transverse Myelitis Association, because there is a big need for them to allow us to follow how they do. And we can't do this without the involvement of patient community. So a lot of what Dr. Schreiner said, she couched, I think, appropriately with caveats about, you know, our limited knowledge, but we can only get smarter about this by partnering up with families.
Thank you, Dr.
A follow-up question regarding IVIG. Is it possible that IVIG administered after the acute phase of TM may still be beneficial to my child, even though there aren't any new lesions or inflammation?
So that's an interesting question. I'll give my answer, and I'm going to see what Dr. Schreiner says as well. I would say that any further therapy for transverse myelitis, whether it's steroids, IVIG, plasma exchange, if I just start with any other therapy, depends on timing and the clinical situation. So in general, if somebody is within 90 days of their onset, and they are not improving, and despite whatever therapy they've had, there is still evidence of inflammation. If their MRI still shows that there's inflammation, then I tend to pursue ongoing treatments. Whether if you've had steroids, you can talk about plasma exchange or IVIG. If you've had one of those, you can do the other. So whether it's IVIG or plasma exchange or any of them, if somebody is still having symptoms and there's still inflammation, then we tend to say, let's give it a try. Now, if you are more than 90 days out, I think the benefit of added acute therapies, again, regardless of what the therapy is pretty limited. And so I would tend to stay away from the acute therapies and focus on the rehabilitation side of things and everything that Dr. Schreiner was talking about.
Thank you, Dr. Greenberg. I agree. I think that with any intervention that I discuss with my families, you have to weigh the risks and the benefits of that intervention. And what we know, or at least I think we know, about transverse myelitis is that the time to intervene is as soon as possible, as soon as that diagnosis has been made, and so that we can address the inflammation. So specifically use these therapies to moderate the immune system, to calm things down. And as time elapses from presentation, we see on MRI that the inflammation is, it wanes. And so if we decide to institute a therapy at month 4 or month 5, the perceived benefit of that, in my mind, is low, whereas the risks, though not high, may still not be worth the lack of benefit. Or said a different way, like it doesn't make sense to institute another therapy when the perceived benefit is so low. So I, in this particular situation, would not recommend continued IVIG therapy if there's no evidence that there's ongoing inflammation, because I think you're introducing something then that has very, very low, if any, benefit and does carry risks with it.
So, Dr. Greenberg, I'd be interested in hearing your answer to this if you've worked with this before. If replacement IgG is needed as a result of long-term Rituxan use for a teen with NMO, is it better to have IVIG or subcutaneous IgG? Is subcutaneous IgG as effective as IVIG?
So, the first comment I'd make is it is really unusual for a patient to need immunoglobulin supplementation after rituximab. I don't know of a case I've had where that's occurred. And so the first thing that would come across my mind is why is the antibody low? Is it really from the from the rituximab, or is there something else going on to lead to a low circulating antibody level? So assuming that is accurate, that it really is what's called hypogamma globulinemia, a low circulating antibody, then there is data to say that both the intravenous and the subcutaneous administration of IVIG lead to adequate absorption. And I would let blood levels tell me if the subcutaneous was adequate or not. And if people don't mind doing it as an injection, then it's simpler to do it that way than with the infusion. But I would stress that I find that, and again, I'd be curious, Terry, how many times have you seen in Rituxan patients them drop their antibody levels? That's not something I'm used to seeing.
No, I have not seen that. I do periodically check IgG levels in my patients on rituximab, but I've never once felt that I needed to replace IgG because of rituximab therapy. So I have no additional insight into that question.
Well, thank you for that. We do have a live question that came in from the Facebook page regarding ADIM. You covered pretty extensively the prognosis for TM, but they were wondering if you could talk more about the prognosis of ADIM, if you think it's different.
Is that a question for me, Sam?
Sure.
Okay. All right. I guess I volunteered for that one. So ADEM, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, is, as I mentioned earlier, vast majority of the time a monophasic disease, and so it only happens once. And so the sequelae after that event should be the only sequelae that you would have, whereas in other relapsing conditions, you may develop other symptoms with each progressive attack. Most patients with ADEM do recover from their attack, and about 50%, maybe slightly more, recover, have a full, at least, motor recovery within several weeks of their attack. And there are certain features of the ADEM attack or clinical characteristics that may give us a clue about prognosis. So, for example, I mentioned that ADEM commonly occurs after viral illnesses or vaccinations. There's some evidence that shows that if you have a rubella or a varicella infection and that is what triggers your ADEM, your outcome may be worse than someone who had a trigger, a different trigger. We know that, as Dr. Greenberg mentioned, I think less than 20% of patients who present with a clinical attack of ADEM will go on to subsequently have a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. And at that point, the prognosis becomes more of a discussion about pediatric or, I guess, adult onset multiple sclerosis than about ADEM. But one other thing I can add about ADEM prognosis is that we commonly see good recovery of motor and sensory changes. But what I think has been under-recognized in the past and is getting more attention now is the neurobehavioral and cognitive sequelae, meaning after an attack of ADEM, kids might behave differently. They might either be quieter or in some cases more boisterous than prior to their attack. And they may have difficulties in school that they didn't have before. So memory, attention, concentration, visual spatial processing, these are all things that can be affected by having had an attack of ADEM. And that I think parents all along have sort of recognized that their children come out of an attack of ADEM just a little bit different than they went in. But now that we're doing more regularly neuropsychiatric testing, I think those differences are becoming more and more understood.
Thank you, Dr. Schreiner. Moving on to some questions regarding treatments for symptoms, specifically spasticity. What are the known long-term effects, and is it safe for children to receive Botox injections long-term into adulthood to treat their spasticity? And also, at what point should a baclofen pump be considered for children with spasticity?
I really want Dr. Schreiner to answer that. But since she did the last one, I'll go ahead and take this one. So the basic answer, as I'm sure everyone can understand, is it is very patient specific. There is not a way to give kind of a global answer to this. In general, I would say long-term Botox use to treat spasticity is a safe thing to do, and that the advantages, if it is working, outweigh any potential risks associated with the long-term use. And so if somebody is using it to treat spasticity and it's working fine, I tend to say leave it alone. And then relative to making the leap to baclofen pumps, again, it's a very individualized situation, and one of the keys is somebody getting benefit from other interventions. A back lymph pump is an invasive procedure. There is an implanted device under the skin and then a catheter that goes from that pump into the spinal canal in order to deliver a low dose of medication into the spinal fluid and treat spasticity. The nice thing about the back lymph pump is we can treat spasticity while not getting systemic side effects from taking a medication orally that will go throughout the whole body. And so there are patients in whom it is makes all the difference in the world. The key is what's been tried, what hasn't been tried, what's working and what isn't working to navigate through those decisions. In the end, if you match the right patient with any of those therapies, the benefits definitely outweigh the risks, because long-term spasticity creates a mountain of issues that can have complications and inhibit recovery in such a way that make the risks of treating the spasticity very much worth it.
Thank you. Dr. Schreiner.
Dr. Greenberg. Yeah, I'll just, I feel it's only fair to comment on that as well, because I think it is a difficult question, and I think you've addressed that risk-benefit balance quite nicely. I think one of the things that I hear from my patients not infrequently about the Botox is, oh my gosh, this is the most poisonous substance to man that there is. Like, why are you encouraging me to inject my child with this? And I think the important thing to remember about Botox is that these are very, very small amounts of botulinum toxin that are being injected directly into the muscles that need them. And so that, I think, is one of the nicest advantages of Botox, is that it is localized and that the effects generally last several months. Now, what we've seen with studies is that over years, the amount of Botox required to get the same effect increases. And so whereas it may have been, you know, 20 units here and 40 units there, at the beginning it's now going to be 30 and 50 or something similar. But I think that is the localized nature of Botox, I think, is a tremendous benefit and asset. And I agree wholeheartedly. I think the intrathecal baclofen is really nice for kids who need it, because it delivers the medicine directly where it needs to be without giving the systemic side effects predominantly of, you know, fatigue, lethargy, and sometimes weight gain. So it can be very nice, but when a baclofen pump is inserted into a child, you need to recognize that there will be pump refills will need to happen at certain intervals. There's a possibility always that the connection between the pump and the spinal canal will be disrupted at some point. There may be other procedures required. And so it is a big step that should be taken mindfully and with discussions with the treating provider.
We have another question live from Facebook. Upon speaking to other parents I've found on the transverse myelitis community, Chiari malformations seem to be prevalent. Why is this, and does this affect the prognosis of the patient, and does having a Chiari malformation increase the chances of multiple sclerosis?
Dr. Schreiner, feel free to go ahead and take this. No.
Okay.
You can go ahead if you want. We can back and forth this one.
Okay, all right.
So we can play am I correct or incorrect? So no data for this.
I would agree.
Anecdotally, this is being discussed more and more. I hear about it from families in terms of Chiari malformations, which we should probably define, actually. Not everybody on the call may know what we're talking about. So a Chiari malformation has to do with the shape and anatomy of the brain. Specifically, there's a part of the brain called the cerebellum, which is the balance center of the brain. It's a large structure at the back of the brain, low down. So if everyone puts their hand on the back of their head, right where their skull meets their neck, it's right behind that piece of bone of skull. That's where the cerebellum lives. And just below the cerebellum, there is a hole in the skull, which is what allows the spinal cord to pass through and connect to the brain. The cerebellum is supposed to sit above that hole called the foramen magnum. But if the bottom part of the cerebellum hangs down into the foramen magnum, into that hole, we call it a Chiari malformation. Now, it's diagnosed based on taking pictures, based on MRIs, but there are lots of different levels of Chiari malformation. So they'll say a Chiari level 1 or level 2, and the higher you go, the more low-hanging the cerebellum is, and the more crowding is occurring in that fixed space, in that hole. There are lots of people walking around with very mild Chiaris, meaning the cerebellum, the way they were built, the way they were born, was that their cerebellum hangs down in the foramen magnum a little bit. In general, we do not feel as though that those are clinically significant relative to transverse myelitis, ADEM, enema, or multiple sclerosis in any way, shape, or form. And the issue has to do with how aggressive was the radiologist in interpreting the MRI. And so we get a lot of reports that talk about Chiaris. When I actually look at the films, I am not impressed in any way, shape, or form. And so part of this, in terms of the growing conversations, I think has to do with overreads by radiologists in terms of Chiaris. That said, it is something that I think is gathering more interest in systematically looking at, is there an association? To my knowledge and in my experience, I do not think there is an association between the malformation, if it is truly there, and risk of one of these diseases. But I am happy to be proven wrong. And Dr. Schreiner, if you have a different experience, please provide
no,
it.
No, I think that is absolutely what I would say is that the people who get MRIs are people who have evidence of central nervous system inflammation. We are not routinely going around and giving MRIs to people that we take off of the street. And if we did, I think we might find that the incidence of Chiari in patients with transverse myelitis, NMO, and ADEM is identical to that of the general population. It's just that we don't know necessarily what the incidence is in the general population because we don't routinely MRI people off the street. So I think this may be a phenomenon of true, and unrelated. I also agree that the distance that the cerebellum protrudes down towards through the foramen magnum is oftentimes just millimeters and clinically silent, asymptomatic, meaning people have this their whole lives and they would never know it if they didn't get the MRI. A small subset of people who have this protrusion down through the foramen magnum and generally more than 1 centimeter, sometimes significantly more than that, that minority will have symptoms of headache, and occasionally that will cause a different problem in the spinal cord called a syrinx, but that is a very different, entirely separate disorder of the spinal cord, not at all related to transverse myelitis.
So we're moving into the last 10 minutes or so of the podcast, so I figured we would finish it up with a few questions regarding the future of the research, starting with what do we know about genetics' role in TM, ADEM, and NMO? There are other children and families with a child who might have one of these diseases who also suffer from autoimmune issues, and could there be a relationship?
So I think in the setting of these diseases, NMO, ADEM, and neuromyelitis optica, I'm actually very comfortable that the risk to family members is extremely small. We've done concerted genetic studies in neuromyelitis optica. We just completed whole genome sequencing of 150 patients. And we really can't find a gene that leads to these disorders. I think what the family reports is that the much more common scenario, and that is there are genetic predispositions for autoimmune diseases, and different members of the family tend to get different ones. So you'll have one member of a family with transverse myelitis, somebody else with thyroid disease, maybe somebody with lupus, and it's quite variable. So in general, when talking to families about this, I say, you know, I'm not worried about a sibling getting one of these conditions, but if they have any unusual symptoms of any kind or illnesses, autoimmune diseases in general should be on the differential list. And so I have a low suspicion for families having a run of transverse myelitis in the family, but a high index of suspicion looking for other autoimmune conditions.
I will add just a little bit to that. I agree wholeheartedly, Dr. Greenberg. When the spinal cord inflammation is subsequently diagnosed as multiple sclerosis, we do know a little bit more about genetic triggers of multiple sclerosis. And so we have certain genes that we can look to and know that those genes are more associated, or they may increase the risk of multiple sclerosis, but only, we think, in conjunction with environmental factors and probably factors that we have not even discovered yet. So in the realm of multiple sclerosis, we know that the risk for the general population is somewhere around 1%, and that first-degree relatives will have a risk that's somewhere close to 5%. So still, in the big scheme of things, a very small risk, but greater than the general population. And so that speaks to both the genetic and environmental triggers that may exist within a family, but that is multiple sclerosis, not idiopathic transverse myelitis, ADEM, or NMO.
And is there any new information on stem cell use in these diseases, and could this be a hopeful treatment in the future?
So, yes, and I think what we're learning relative to stem cells is we need to broaden our thinking and understanding and language relative to cell-based interventions for these conditions. I think most people have in their mind an image of you go into a clinic, you get infused with a, quote, stem cell, and it migrates to the area of damage and then regrows an intact nervous system. And I don't think that's actually going to be ultimately how this works, although in some instances it will be exactly how it works. There's one avenue of research doing just that, looking at regrowing parts of the nervous system. Then there's another avenue of research that uses medications to stimulate a body's own stem cells to repair damage that's been done. Both avenues of research are progressing, but I'll be honest, the targets so far picked by investigators and industries involved in this research have been more prevalent diseases, specifically multiple sclerosis and spinal cord injury. And one of the things we've been working with the Transverse Myelitis Association on is trying to increase the awareness and visibility of our patient populations, ADEM, transverse myelitis, and NMO, because we think as a patient population they represent a very unique and advantageous group when studying stem cell therapies. We want our patients to be first in line for recipients of these therapies. And it goes back to the studies I referenced. The response we get from companies who are going to invest millions, hundreds of millions, and billions of dollars in these therapies is we need to see the outcome data. We need to see what happens to patients without stem cells in order to appropriately design trials. So things like the CAPTURE study, which the Transverse Myelitis Association is helping to lead, work that happens at these clinics as Dr. Schreiner follows patients and recruits individuals for clinical research, as we do it here at UT, the group at Hopkins, CHOP in Pennsylvania, et cetera. All of these research investigations are part of coordinated efforts to get smarter about these conditions so that our patients can help or can both help and be recipients of things like stem cell therapy? So the short answer is yes, it is progressing. There are a multitude of different studies at various stages. Unfortunately, none of the studies in clinical practice right now are recruiting individuals with these conditions, and we have work to do to change that reality.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I agree. I will add just one thing, which is that it makes me nervous when my families come to me and say that they are researching stem cell therapies out of the country. And part of my...
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
I love that. Thanks for saving me on that one.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm happy to discuss that because I think it's important that we don't know what is being done at these sites outside the country, and that makes me very nervous. I think that the idea of drawing blood, removing some sort of stem cell, and then reinfusing that is, we're still in sort of the infancy of our knowledge of how to administer and execute on that. And we know that it's happening in other countries, but the details of that are unknown. It's too soon. And I discourage my families from going there yet because I think, again, that could be a very risky and certainly expensive endeavor with questionable results.
And I really appreciate the comment and just want to add one quick anecdote about that. You know, on YouTube and on the Internet, the only thing people hear about are the successes that after traveling to Costa Rica or Panama City or Germany or China, people who were in a wheelchair and then could walk again. Whether these are valid or not, I'm not sure. What you don't hear about, strangely enough, are any of the things where things go wrong. I can document known 2 patients deceased after undergoing overseas, quote-unquote, stem cell therapies, one from the Texas area, one from the Maryland area, that do not have YouTube videos posted up about what happened to them. And so there is a great media campaign happening on the Internet about these therapies, but as Dr. Schreiner said, the safety is of a grave concern, and whether or not, frankly, these clinics are charlatans is a concern of mine. There was a huge clinic in Costa Rica doing stem cell therapy for years. I had patients going down there at $30,000 to $40,000 a treatment, and then it would wear off, quote-unquote, after 6 months, and they'd go for another one. The Costa Rican government shut the clinic down. I don't take that as a very good sign. 2 weeks later, they were open in Panama City, and now I have patients who go to Panama for it. And so I really encourage people to be very careful. We all want to have hope. We all want to have open minds. We all want to be looking for the breakthroughs. But the reason we do employ scientific methods and regulatory agencies in the work we do in the United States is both to protect us from individuals who would take advantage of us and to protect us from ourselves relative to making rash decisions with incomplete data. So I really urge people to think twice before taking those trips.
Thank you both, Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Schreiner, for being with us today. In the last couple minutes, I just thought if you two would like to have some closing remarks about this topic before we close out for the day.
Dr. Schreiner, would you like to go first?
Well, I'm happy to. Thank you. So I think if I were to put forth one message, it would be that of optimism. I think we are learning so much all the time, not only about the risk factors for these diseases so that we will perhaps someday be able to intervene to stop them. We're learning about the treatments both in the acute phase as well as the long phase, and we are gathering more understanding of how to maximize function and really empower patients who have had some disability from these attacks to lead vibrant and productive lives. And so I think we are really in an exciting phase right now, and that great things are coming. So I'm happy to be part of the TMA, who is really taking an active interest in pushing this research along and working on quality of life for these patients?
I guess I would close, obviously, by echoing what Dr. Schreiner said quite eloquently. And I'd take it one step further. I think the optimism is there. I would encourage people to get involved. I think in it's true for any organization or anything in life, whether it's a PTA at a school or a church or a hospital or a workplace, or a nonprofit organization like the TMA, a patient advocacy group. In general, there's about 1 to 5% of people who do 95 to 99% of the work, and that's great. And it's wonderful to have people who are passionate about the work and dedicated to the work. And the TMA has a very broad network. I think it's actually more than 1 to 5% in reference to this group. But I would encourage everyone on this call, including friends, families, and other patients you talk to get involved. Whether it's taking part in a walk sponsored around the country, whether it's helping the TMA get out the word, whether it's helping newly diagnosed families who are going through so much in the first 90 days from diagnosis understand the importance of taking part in research. There are lots of ways to get involved and to help change the face of this disease. We are working as fast and as hard as we can. It's never fast enough, and it's never hard enough. But the more people who are working with us, the faster this will go. So I encourage people to get involved.
Again, thank you both, Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Schreiner, for sharing your expertise with us today. And thank you to all of our listeners who spend your time learning from the experts that we have here. And for all of your questions, please keep them coming. And look forward to more announcements for next month's podcast. We look forward to your questions then. Thanks, and everybody have a great weekend.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.